Hello and what is shaking, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and today we are getting into marketing. This is something that was an episode probably kind of long time coming, but really was spurred on by another question that we got via email and something that we could have incorporated into kind of our monthly Q&A episodes, but realistically kind of needed just a longer time frame to get through it all, I think. So we're going to dive into it between labels, websites, how brands shift or move or change things, and what really, you know, we think works or maybe doesn't work for you all, the consumers out there. Before we get too far into it, as always, we have a couple of quick announcements. Number one, for those of you that are in the Carolinas or the Midwest, our events on the road start this week. The HBIC herself is going to be out in the Charleston area, Mount Pleasant, tonight. She will be in Charlotte as well as Durham throughout this week. I will be on the road at the end of the month. We're starting off in Columbus, then we're heading to Indianapolis, and then Nash, Vegas, heading back to Nashville. Tickets and all kinds of information on how to attend those events can be found on our website. That's mtgawines.com. You can click on the upcoming events or on the shop link. It'll show you the tickets, all the details, all that good stuff. Tickets are still available to those events. So even if it's last minute and all of a sudden you can make it, please, we would love to have you join us while we're out and about. While you're on our website, and I mentioned kind of our Q&A episodes just briefly in the intro there, if you want to submit your own questions or there are things you're curious about the winemaking process, hospitality, sales, the business aspect of the industry, you can stick to our website there, mtgawines.com. Just scroll down on the homepage. There's a little web kind of email box that you can fill out there. Hit submit, and that'll get sent directly my way, and we try and answer those questions either in a longer form episode such as this one, or we'll plug it into our monthly Q&A episode that we do the last week of each month. While I have this glorious attention of yours, be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines, primarily on YouTube and the Instagram. We're also on the Book of Face, as well as the social network formerly known as Twitter. You can check us out at MTGA Wines. For those of you that are continuing to listen to the show, we thank you so much for coming back, for continuing to listen. Be sure to share it with your wine-loving friends. Like and subscribe to the show when possible. And if you can leave a little rating or review wherever you're consuming the podcast, that goes a long way in terms of kind of increasing its reach out there on the interweb. So much appreciated if you can knock that out. All right, so let's talk marketing, shall we? And this question was really directed towards labels specifically. Big shout out to Mike out in the Carolinas who posed this question via email last week. This was something that it's a great question, kind of how we in this industry kind of approach our branding and our marketing and all this stuff. But it really needs kind of a larger conversation. And kind of the gist of the question was, you know, when do wineries change some of this stuff? You know, if it starts to be a little outdated or maybe not something that looks or feels maybe how it should from a consumer perspective, potentially, you know, when do wineries decide to make these changes? How do they make these changes? And I want to get into that for sure. We'll touch base on it. But I want to start the conversation kind of on my theory of marketing in particular. This is something that I worked on for many, many brands over the years. This is something that, frankly, I don't think changes that much, except for subtle tweaks based on kind of who you are, what your company is doing. There are certain things that, yeah, sure, need adjustments and, you know, changes that should be made as the years go on. This is something that we do for our own business and that many businesses will do, whether it's just refreshing the branding a little bit, changing how things look or feel. It certainly happens. But more importantly, when it comes to marketing, I think you need to key in to one of like two things. And it really depends on, I think, your scale and kind of the goals of your business. And the first will kind of go the go big scenario, right? You're trying to be a brand that's out there in the mix. You're on retail shelves. You're in restaurants. You know, and we're talking the wine industry specifically here, of course, but, you know, apply this to, I think, many other businesses as well, where if you're trying to be a well-known name and something that has that kind of brand recognition where it's like, you know, someone walks into a restaurant and they're like, oh, I'm not really sure what wine I want, but I know this one's always really good. And I know I can buy this and it's reliable, and I can impress my friends with my wine knowledge by buying this, you know, wine that maybe they've never heard of, but I have a lot of faith in. If you want to have that kind of cachet and that brand recognition, if you want to jump off the retail shelf, clearly you need to have some, you know, something outside of just like the wine quality. You need to have that brand recognition, you know. And there are going to be plenty of competitors that try and, you know, vie for that shelf space, that vie for that, you know, space on the restaurant list. I mean, think of like the old Pepsi Challenge back in the day. That Coca-Cola still continues to be, you know, the more popular soft drink. But the Pepsi Challenge was a great way of saying like, hey, let us prove to you that you like our soda better than this one. And it was a great marketing tactic. And it may have worked, may not have worked. Over the course of those years, but at least it was fun and kind of interesting, and it kind of hit home with some people and maybe convinced some people like, you know what, maybe I'll try a Pepsi, or I know I'm a Coca-Cola fan, but if they only have Pepsi, I'm not too worried about it. You know, I'm not going to be a stick in the mud kind of thing. So you need that kind of brand recognition. On top of that, when it comes to like your marketing material, let's say your label, the capsule or screw cap, the cork, whatever the case may be, that needs to be very easy to identify. You know, think of when you're, if you're cruising through a liquor store or a wine shop and you see that silver like half dome label with a particular water tower on it, you're like, oh, well, there's the Silver Oak, right? You don't even need to see the name or the script on the label. You're just like, oh, I know exactly what that is because that's what Silver Oak looks like. You could see something like the half like silver foil on Ridge from the Santa Cruz Mountains. You're like, well, there's no one else that has those like half foils, and rarely anyone uses silver. So that's got to be the Ridge bottle. You can see the blue and kind of gold or yellow, I think that's on Rombauer. You can see kind of the intricate nature of like the Farniente labels, Camus, and how they're organized. Like there's the Prisoner and kind of that vibe that it has. Apothic Red, for what it's worth, on kind of the cheap and cheerful red blend side of things. There are certain, you know, there's certain imagery and styles and things that kind of lean into what a certain brand is trying to do. And if you're trying to be kind of that nationally recognized brand, you need something that's very distinct, that jumps off the shelf, and then something that's easy for people to identify, right? And I think that that's kind of like the go big or go home scenario. You also need it to, you know, kind of say the right thing. You need to have it be, you know, provide context for that wine. You need to be able to instill some sort of consumer confidence when they pick up and potentially read that back label. Information should be relatively easy to access. It has to be a certain price point, more often than not. And of course, the quality has to come with it, right? If you're going to be a nationally recognized brand, if your wine sucks, it's not going to get you very far. So it has to be halfway decent. Now, the other side of that coin is going to be, let's say, the more small kind of boutique brands like ourselves, you know, something that's maybe a few thousand cases, couple thousand cases or less. And this is where it can be a little bit trickier, because you don't necessarily have kind of the luxury of kind of mass marketing, right? And I do consider that a little bit of a luxury. If you have the ability to kind of be everywhere and easy to recognize and be present in certain places, it's a lot easier to garner kind of consumer attention just from the number of impressions that you're going to make. Now, this is always the argument that I have with impressions, is what's the ROI on those? If you're paying for, you know, this is how some marketers, when it comes to like social media or web design or advertising, they say, this is the number of impressions you're going to get. I'm like, okay, well, what's the conversion rate on those impressions? Of the 100,000 people that are going to see this ad, can I expect 10,000 of them to go to our website? Can I expect 1,000 of them to peruse our products? Can I expect 100 of them to buy? What's the ratio here? And more often than not, they don't have that data, which is unfortunate. At least that's my own experience. Some of them surely do. But, you know, it's really tough to kind of figure out what, you know, the actual conversion rate is on some of that stuff. So impressions kind of only get you so far, but it's nice to be front of mind. It's like that little bit of like subliminal marketing, right? Of like, hey, if you're just in the mix and present, people are going to naturally think of you, think of the product, and maybe lean towards it a little bit easier than they might somebody else's. Sure, makes sense. That's why I think that when you're kind of a larger brand, it can be a little bit easier to market yourself. And typically your marketing budget's going to be a little bit more than, say, what mine is. But them is just the ropes. So when it comes to, you know, how small brands market themselves, I truly believe it keys into one thing, and that's authenticity. I'm going to mention that a lot during this episode because marketing as a small brand is tough. You can't necessarily compete with those big guys. There's a lot of other small people out there, and a lot of folks like yourselves love to support us mom and pop shops, but there's only so many that you can key into. And what makes, you know, say our brand versus somebody else's more important to you, the consumer? And I think authenticity is something that many brands don't do a good enough job of keying into. Some of that is because it can be hard to, right? It is a very different scenario, like what we're doing, you know, where you have a husband and wife duo that literally do everything. If we're on the road, one of us is on the road, one of us is here, you know, managing stuff from the business perspective. We're entering the orders, we're doing the accounting, we're doing all the seller work, we're managing bottlings, we're doing all the things. We do not have a hired team. We don't have any consultants outside of a tax guy, because it's important to get those done at least efficiently so that, you know, the good old IRS doesn't come tracking you down. I'd prefer not to have that happen. So we hire somebody for the accounting a little bit, but outside of that, we do everything else, you know? So it's really easy for us to honestly be authentic, because this is just our life. This is our livelihood. This wine business of ours is how we put food on the table. It's how I afforded this microphone that I'm talking into right now. It's how I have this roof over my head. Support from folks like you is what allows us to continue doing what we do. So it's really easy for the two of us to be authentic and just share our story and our passion for this industry and our wines with you. It can be a lot tougher for smaller brands that maybe kind of have those pseudo like absentee owners that, you know, no harm, no foul, did really well for themselves, maybe in a prior career, whether that's in finance or tech or whatever the case is, and have a, quote, passion for wine and have dreamed of owning a winery someday, end quote. And here they are now buying a place in Napa for tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, hiring a bunch of consultants and a team to manage it for them, and now they're slinging their own juice. Cool. Very exciting for you. Glad you're a part of this industry. I hope you understand how much work it actually is. And luckily, many of these folks are very entrepreneurial. They know the grind. It's not as though they're these spoiled brats, although we do run into those every once in a while as well. But clearly, when you're not doing the cellar work, when you're not doing the vineyard work, when you're not actually plugged into the day-to-day operations of the business, you're just looking at spreadsheets and P&Ls, it's a very different thing than actually being a part of it. And that can be really tough to sell. It can be really tough to convey authenticity to the consumer as a small brand if your ownership are, let's face it, unrelatable. Right? The overwhelming majority of people don't necessarily live that life. They don't have an estate or many, many homes across many, many continents. They can't decide to winter, you know, in Spain and then summer somewhere else or whatever the case may be, right? There are going to be some challenges with that. I know there are challenges because I have plenty of friends who work for some of these folks that are truly passionate about wine. They really, really enjoy it. They love having a wine business, but they know nothing about the wine industry. And so these folks that work in sales, that are GMs, that are hospitality or VPs of marketing or whatever they are, now have to find ways to manufacture this brand marketing in a way that's going to be advantageous for sales. It's a tall order. It's something that personally I can't do. I have a very, very hard time with it. And some of you know my past and you know, working for other brands. You say, but Mike, you've worked for people, you know, who have done very well for themselves in these big companies. You know, the first being Boisse Family Estates, kind of the first big brand and kind of conglomerate that I worked for. And I say, absolutely. However, if you have met or know Jean-Charles at all, you know that he is unabashedly himself. And authenticity is something that he basically bleeds. This is something that I will always go to bat for that guy, not that he needs it. But from a big business standpoint and someone who's, in essence, like omnipresent in everything he's always got going on from a wine business standpoint, the dude is on top of it. You can't say, I mean, that's just the way it is. So I'm not going to take anything away from that guy. Number two would be Gary and Kit at Cliff Family Wines. But these are two folks that were, they lived here. They're here a lot of the time. We saw them all the time. They were in our meetings. We had regular conversations with them. There were people that were present and involved in the process. They weren't being absentee owners. Yes, they had a lot of things going on, and yes, they had hired a team to manage a lot of this for them, but they always were present, and they always had a way of, and this is going to sound kind of bad, but like inserting themselves into the business in ways that were really meaningful and ensuring that, you know, the consumers that they would connect with felt as though they were, you know, supposed to be there. My favorite stories of, you know, working for Cliff Family is, you know, for those of you that have been there off of Main Street here in St. Helena, is we had a great espresso machine, and we are a big stop for cyclists, as you might imagine, knowing the Cliff Bar connection. And it was on a regular basis. Either Gary or Kit would come in, they would be grabbing lunch off the food truck, or Gary would come in and make himself an espresso off the espresso machine. And for like the normal public that were sitting at the bar, they're like, who's this guy coming in like spandex and Lycra, you know, with a backwards hat on and just making himself a coffee? Like, who's this guy? And he would just hang out, make himself a coffee, chat with people. Folks would kind of realize like who he was and what he did. And he didn't talk a big game. He was never someone that like demanded people's attention, but immediately sat there and like took time to get to know the people that were supporting his wine business. And that's an outstanding thing. That's what I think, frankly, ownership should be doing, but there are plenty that don't do that. And it can be very hard to market that, as you might imagine. So I think those are kind of like hopefully a couple like good examples of marketing wine and kind of the basis of the conversation that we're going to have today. Now, Mike, the question that you posed was, you know, when do wineries start to change, you know, their labels, maybe their marketing? You know, is there a certain time frame for that? Are there certain things, you know, from one generation to the next that might, you know, cause that to happen? Because certainly there are certain labels that look and maybe feel a certain way. There are other labels that maybe look and feel a certain way. Now, I'm going to start this with kind of a very practical side of it. And this kind of boils down to just the cost of rebranding and doing things. Because if you're going to start with rebranding your product specifically, like talking the labels here, that bleeds into, you know, this, or you know, kind of cascades or bleeds into, you know, your website, your social media, your corks, the glass bottles you might be using, your business cards and collateral. Like there's all kinds of other stuff that comes down the pipeline if you're going to do kind of an overhaul of your label. Because if it doesn't quite line up just right, then, you know, maybe there can be an issue there. And the brand recognition that we were talking about kind of could be off, even with your own consumers to a certain extent. You don't necessarily want to like turn people off at all, right? Because you don't want to necessarily lose that, you know, bit of market share that you have. And if people don't recognize it, that can be a problem. Sure. So, you know, if you're going to start with like a label redesign, that usually means you're going to have to change everything else. Now, I've worked on, you know, plenty of webs and built plenty of websites over the years. It can be relatively affordable with every, you know, with plenty of the website hosting companies. A lot of it's plug and play right now. Realistically, with a little bit of time and some know-how, you can do it yourself. It's not hard. If you have a website that doesn't function properly in this day and age, I just want to take you out back and like spray you down with a cold hose, because it's like, what are you doing? Like this is so easy and it's so cheap. The integrations, whatever you need, we can make happen. If you need to link to somewhere else, we can make that happen. Like this is so simple. It's so simple. You know, when websites don't function correctly, I mean, you might be like me. If it takes me more than 2 clicks to get anywhere, I stop paying attention really fast. I start getting frustrated. It shows you the attention span that I probably have. But it's the truth, because it needs to just work. If it doesn't work, you have problems, especially in this day and age where it needs, especially when it's on a phone, it's got to be mobile optimized. The fact that, you know, stuff like that's like included in plans now. Like if you're having a hard time optimizing a phone for like a website for mobile in this day and age, you need to quit your web service and just do an overhaul anyway. Tangent aside, if you're going to just start with like a website, you can spend thousands, tens of thousands of dollars on web design, hosting, all that other stuff. Keep in mind, you also probably have to do a decent amount of photography, videography, however you want it to look and however you want it to feel. There's a lot of other creative stuff that goes into it. So it's a big investment up front. You know, I have the benefit of knowing how to do a lot of that. I have a passion for photography. Luckily, these handy dandy devices that we call phones, even though we just use them for, you know, doom scrolling and taking pictures these days, you know, they can do decent video work, decent photography work, and you can basically do this on a dime if you really wanted to. Now, if you want like real professional photography done, you got to pay for that kind of stuff, obviously. But, you know, if you're just going to start with this kind of marketing rebrand, you got to think of that kind of stuff as well, and that cascading effect, and the probably tens of thousands of dollars that you're going to need to spend on everything that comes down the pipeline, right? Some of the websites I designed and helped put together were to the tune of somewhere between like $40,000 to $80,000 just for the website. And some of the functionality on them sucked because certain people wanted certain designs that weren't functional, and trying to convey that to them was challenging. And we ended up with websites that I was not proud of, but they looked really pretty. But from a functionality standpoint, they were just an absolute disaster. Oh, they were such a mess. But they looked nice. I mean, looks count for something, I guess. But man, it was frustrating. I'm sure they've had to redo some of those by this point. But man, that was a big expense. You know, I think the design team that was kind of in charge of it, I was kind of the person providing some insight or trying to kind of rein some of it in, it felt like. And it fell on deaf ears. And unfortunately, we had problems with that. But random story aside, you can spend lots of money on that, right? Now, that's if you're kind of like doing a complete and total like overhaul. But let's say you like the framework of what you're working with, right? And let's say the labels are something that you want to update, you know, from the color scheme, maybe the stock that it's on, maybe you want to go to screen printing versus paper labels, like whatever the case may be. There's plenty that you can do, of course. There's all kinds of bells and whistles and options. You can pay a designer to do all kinds of stuff for you. I can tell you that I am not super proficient in Adobe Illustrator or design work, so I outsource a little bit of that because I need help making sure that when I send our labels to a printer that they can actually understand the files and print them the way they need to be to look even remotely professional. I can't do that. I need to pay somebody to do that, which is someone could range from, I mean, maybe if you're lucky, as little as like 75 or 85, probably more like 85 to like 120 an hour minimum, probably closer to like 125 north of that per hour if you're going to really try and get someone who's a professional to get this kind of stuff done for you. That's just the reality. So there's the upfront cost of like just designing the label on top of that. Now, here's kind of like it's not like a dirty little secret, but a secret of like the printing industry, at least as far as I know, is that when you submit like some of those files for printing, they create like plates and stuff for you so that they can basically like rattle off your print jobs as quickly as possible. But you got to pay for those setup fees. You got to pay for the plates. The first time you print a label is the most expensive time you're going to do it because of all the setup fees. I mean, it can be to the tunes of thousands of dollars. If you're doing like a total rebrand and you have multiple labels like we do, you're going to have to redo all of them. And that means you're going to be spending a ton of money trying to get that all dialed in, right? And now if you're doing, you know, embellishments, if you're embossing the label at all, if you're going to use any foiling, if you're going to use a heat stamp, if you're going to do any die cuts, all these little kind of things that maybe you don't necessarily notice, but, you know, it makes the label look cool, you know, just because as the complete package, it looks rad. Everything that you try and throw at that label is going to come at a certain expense. So not only are you talking about some like the other stuff down the line between like website collateral, all of those things, and maybe you're just taking new photos, maybe you're just taking new videos. You might have to pay somebody to do that, but if you're halfway decent, maybe you can do it yourself. But even then, it's still time. Your time is money, and you need to recognize that. But if you're going to pay a professional, obviously it's probably going to be a little bit more expensive, depending on what your personal hourly rate is. I know what mine is. It's not that expensive, so it's a good deal for us. So anyway, when it comes to that like label redesign, it's just expensive up front. You're paying the designer, you have to work with, you know, all of the printers and try and sort it out, you know, whether you're screen printing or using paper labels, whatever the case may be. Etching, forget about it, it's fucking expensive as shit. Etching is dumb. I hate etching. For anyone that asks, like on large formats, it's cool, but it costs if you're only doing a handful of large formats, it can cost like $200 per bottle just to etch something. Like, it's so dumb. It's a total racket as far as I'm concerned. But it looks pretty. Tell you what, it looks pretty. So you have to think of that, you know, and kind of the upfront expense of, you know, and your budget, right? Because if you're going to do this rebranding kind of thing from a marketing perspective, right, to like freshen things up, you're going to have to budget for it. It's going to be a serious line item. It's going to be tens of thousands of dollars, a lot of hours. I mean, if not more than that, plenty of hours, lots of video work, lots of photography work, web design, printing, all the things. So when it comes to like doing some of these refreshes or rebrands, it doesn't necessarily happen all that often. It certainly doesn't happen regularly because it's just fucking expensive, man. It just is. And for those brands that do that kind of stuff, you know, it can be really pricey. I mean, you do have some people like the Cinquenons of the world, or maybe, I can't remember which Rothschild brand in France has like the painting that changes every year. Clos Pegase used to do that with their Hommage wine, actually. They would have a different piece of artwork on there. But that was a pretty cheap label to print because it was just like a digital print file, really affordable to do. But you still had to pay for the licensing and the rights of the painting and all that other stuff. So there's that, which can add cost, of course, to that bottle. But I'll give you a good like perspective. So when we were designing a new label, this is one of the newer labels we were designing, and this would have been 17, 18 or so. We were coming out with our red blend, the Repichage, which some of you are familiar with. Now, when we designed that label, it was a very different shape, different style. It was kind of a throwback to my rowing days in college with more not like of a nautical theme. And of course, the verbiage, you know, kind of insinuates that as well. And I wanted to do something kind of cool and special for this red blend because it was going to be kind of this small kind of fun production that we're doing. When push came to shove and we were trying to do this design and kind of get it done the way we wanted to get it done, rather than being like, you know, frugal about it, that label, that first vintage we printed those labels, the label cost us $7 per bottle. Think about that for a second. That's more than I spent on barrels for that wine. $7 per bottle. The barrel cost on that wine probably would have been somewhere in like the $5 to $7 range, but it was certainly less than that. The label itself was somewhere in the $7 to $8 range. It was crazy. We spent way more than we probably should have, way more than we needed to, but we were on this verge of like becoming a real wine brand. It was like, hey, we got to make sure that the label looks good and feels good. And it's got some embossing and it looks professional and all this other stuff. So we're going to spend way more money than we're used to spending on printing our labels because we feel as though that's the right thing to do. And after that experience, I've been very, very hesitant to spend that kind of money again on labels, save things like our Grand Cask, which are like the screen printed really nice labels, because for the quality of that wine, the expense of making it, you know, we're kind of going whole hog into that thing. We're like, okay, like we're going to go big or go home with this. Yes, this screen printing is expensive, even more expensive than that label I just mentioned, but it's worth it because man, does it look good. And man, does it tell our story and kind of connect with what we're trying to do with this particular wine. More on that in a hot second. So with that Repichage that I mentioned and having that really expensive label up front, that's the kind of stuff you deal with. And it can be tougher as a small brand as well because you're not necessarily hitting like the printing minimums for a lot of this stuff, right? This is true of any business, realistically, is that, I mean, small businesses are naturally at a disadvantage. Everything is built around scale. Everything is built around doing more. And if you're trying to be a small business, it's really tough. You have to pay top dollar for everything. We do not get any price breaks at all, period. When we do our screen printing, for example, I just mentioned, if we do less than, I think it's either 75 or 100 cases, we still have to pay as if we are printing that 75 or 100 cases. So if we're doing 25 cases, we have to pay 3 or 4X. That's the name of the game because we're not doing enough for that company to even make it worth their time. They'll do it for us, but at a premium. That's the kind of stuff that we have to deal with. So when it comes to like some, you know, marketing, rebranding, or label changes as a small business, it's even more of a financial burden because it's already expensive as shit for us to do this stuff as it is. If we're going to take on tens of thousands of dollars more in redesigns, I mean, that could sink your ship unless you've got a really robust thing going. Now, I mentioned kind of telling our story and the importance of like authenticity when it comes to branding and marketing, especially when it comes to a small label. And this gets to kind of the crux of why I'm hesitant and typically why we don't see the need or feel the need to change our labels dramatically. And I think this kind of speaks for a lot of small producers, or can potentially. And this is something that I'm very, very proud to say, is that the overwhelming majority, I'm talking 99% of the people who have tried our wines have met Brittany or I personally. I can bank on that number. It is incredibly few and far between that someone purchases our wines and has no idea who we are as people and as a couple. We've hung out with them. I've shaken their hand. We've met at a wine tasting or an event or a dinner somewhere. Even if the wine is in a, you know, wine shop or restaurant, we have, you know, a sommelier there or a salesperson there that can tell, that, you know, knows us personally and can help share our story with people as well. We do a ton of marketing ourselves to really key people into the authenticity that our brand has between our, you know, endeavors in this industry, you know, everything that we do day to day just to keep this business going. I mean, look no further than some of our social networks and kind of what we post on a, you know, mostly regular basis and trying to kind of bring you into our world. We don't just post the sexy, beautiful photos and landscapes and speak esoterically about, you know, the scenery and how we gently caress the barrels as the wine is aging and this, that, and the other thing. We bring you into the down and dirty. We try to show you what this industry actually is. That it's a lot of hard work, it's a lot of getting your hands dirty, and man, is it a grind. It really, really is. Now, you can still make a pretty decent living at it. You might not get rich quick, but it can earn you a living, which we are all, the both of us, are very thankful for. But because we have a personal connection to everybody on our mailing list, certainly everybody in our wine clubs, people that we've done dinners and events with, do we really need, as a brand, do we really need to change our marketing? If we're not going to be, you know, widespread in retail and retail shops and in, you know, restaurants around the country, do we really need an eye-catching, like, poppy label? Or does it just need to tie into who we are and what we do? You know, I'll fully admit, like, MTGA as a brand name sucks. It's pretty bad. It's the worst. Could be the worst. It's on par. Because no one can remember it, much less what it stands for. And it's tough for people to, like, wrap their head around. Now, there are a handful of folks out there that would be like, oh, no, it's, you know, it's Michael. It's, you know, his name. His dad was Todd. His grandpa Gus, Gustav, you know, they were the first two winemakers in the family. You know, when he started his label, he wanted to tie it back to his family. He's a third generation winemaker. Those were the first two winemakers in the family. So it's this great, like, continuation of this winemaking family and their legacy here in Napa. That's what it is. And that keys into some people. And some people remember that. You know, for me, it's no different than having Rombauer on the label. It's like, oh, here's the last name. Rombauer doesn't mean anything necessarily. I mean, sure, there's some definition to it. I could probably look it up, but I'm not going to. But that's the family last name. You know? Realistically, like, you could also look at, like, a brand similar to, or like, Meiomi. Like, that means, I mean, I can't even remember what that's supposed to mean, but there's, like, some meaning behind it as, like, a, you know, big, as a big brand. Like, even they try and, like, tie it into something, you know, so that way you know that there's some passion behind it, even though that there's, like, you know, 20 grams per liter of sugar in there, right? So that even though it's, like, alcoholic Kool-Aid that hey, there's this cool word that we have that means something. Drink our wine. there's my taking a shot for a day, for today anyway. You know, like I understand that our branding kind of sucks. I'm not worried about it because we get to meet and hang out with people on one-on-one and on a personal basis. Even like the little bit of distribution that we do, people understand who we are and what we do. And when I go into a retail shop or a restaurant and try and sell our wine, albeit that's pretty few and far between, I get to connect with those people because I've got some, you know, cachet, for better or for worse. One, on the winemaker, that goes a long way when you're on the road. Number two, when you're the third generation, you know, in Napa and you're making wine and you've been doing it for a decade and a half, that gives you some street cred. And when I can tie that back to the story and who we are and provide people kind of that authenticity that I think most consumers are looking for in this day and age, it works. And if there's a point in time when it stops working, then yeah, we'll probably make some adjustments. But even that's happened more recently. Like, we're starting to put the variety on the front of our labels. We're putting the QR code on the back of a lot of our labels so that you can link to our website and see exactly how we make our wines, what goes into them. Like, we're doing a lot to try and enhance, you know, our label designs without overhauling them, you know, and having to pay all of that money and spending all that time doing that kind of stuff. So there are subtle tweaks and ways you can kind of, you know, make some of those changes, which is great, right? But for all intents and purposes, when it comes to like this small brand, small marketing thing, I truly believe you have to tie into something that is truly authentic. You know, if your name or names in my situation are going to be on the label, what does that actually tie into? Why is that important? And the fact that we, Brittany and I, can explain that why to people one-on-one more often than not gives us a big head start on a lot, and I mean a lot of people. And I'm truly of the belief that that is why we have been successful despite a lot of odds being stacked up against us. I mean, think about this for a hot second as I can kind of continue down this tangent. Is that I started making Merlot 16 years ago when it was the least popular wine in the US. I started making Riesling second, the two hardest grapes to sell in this country outside of maybe Petite Syrah and Syrah. Like, those are the only other two varieties that are kind of a tough sell in this country. And it was a pain to get that started. On top of starting with two varieties that suck to sell, I had a brand name that no one could remember, that no one understood. Yet somehow 16 years later, it's still a thing and has been growing. So I feel as though we've done something right. So this is kind of like in defense of our current labels, so to speak. You know, I don't want to break something just for the sake of breaking it to try and fix it again. And I think that's where some wineries do go awry. Actually, I'll be honest with you. I think this is something that Con Valley did through some mismanagement from a prior GM, is they did a big branding overhaul. And the new labels, frankly, are tough to read. They don't really tie into the place all that well. You know, the old white paper label, yeah, it was super dated and probably needed some updating. But it went and swung to this really crazy extreme. And me personally, I'm not a huge fan of it. Hopefully other people like it. You know, they're not selling the wine to me. You know, if the business is as successful as my folks say they're doing, because I'm not involved, you know, then good on them. If it works, it works. And to that end, don't break it. Don't fix it if it's not broken, right? But if you're having a hard time and you need something to refresh and something to change, then maybe it is time to review your marketing and your labels and your website and your social media and everything that you're doing. I think that we're in a pretty good place considering the state of the industry, the state of the wine world right now. Things are tight. It's a big challenge to be a part of this industry right now. If you have a good thing going for you, now is not the time to break it down to try and rebuild it again. Financially, it's incredibly irresponsible when times are tight. unless, you know, you're one of those billionaires with a capital B and you just feel like you need a refresh, then more power to you. You go do you, bae. I think that, you know, when it comes to this like marketing conversation, this was a really broad kind of like broad brushstroke, you know, kind of explanation of it all. But I think if you key into some of that stuff in terms of, you know, what's your scale? What are you actually trying to do? Do you need to be recognizable on a shelf in the middle of, you know, Tulsa or, you know, Seattle or Houston or wherever your wines are going to be? Do you need to like pop off that shelf? Do you need that name recognition on every wine list because you want to be in every steakhouse and every chain in the country? Or are you going to do the more boutique mom and pop thing and just build connections with your consumers and know people on a personal level? You know, there's no wrong answer, but it can be tough to do both of those, potentially. It can also just be tough to do one or the other. But in some way, shape, or form, you gotta put, you know, you gotta lay in one of those camps. And you need to find a way to be authentic in either of those camps. And if you can't do that, then you can't do much. That's just how it is. So no matter how annoying a brand name might be, or how dated some of the branding could also be as well, it could still hit home for people. It could still work. Maybe it needs a refresh. Maybe there are things that can be added or adjusted or changed. Sure. Absolutely. That could certainly be the case. But I'll tell you this much. I still stand by it. If it's not broken, don't fix it. I'm sure there would come a day, you know, if we get another 10 years down the line here, you know, there might be a chance that we change up our labels, you know. I'm sure that many brands consider that, you know, as times have changed and styles have changed and technology has changed, then it's like, all right, maybe it's time that we, you know, try and capitalize on some of this and, you know, really enhance the look and feel of what we do. But I don't think that time is now, you know, for us, and given the state of the world and sales and all the other things that are going on, I don't think it's the time for anybody. But that's my own two cents. All right, everybody. This has been the Wind Up Podcast. This marketing thing, it's tough. It's tough. It's this weird, like, amorphous thing. I don't think truly there's no right answer. I do think, truthfully, that authenticity thing, like, that is, like, the key component, whether you're big or small. Know what you're doing and do it really, really well. Don't treat people like mushrooms. Do not keep them in the dark and feed them shit. For those of you that love the movie The Departed, you're welcome. But that's what some brands will try and do. It's the truth. And it's kind of a shame. You know, whether it's the absentee owners who have the passion and they love the Napa community and scene and they're so thankful for their opportunities here, but they spend, you know, 11 months out of the year not here, not working at the winery, not doing the work. You know, that's not necessarily authentic now, is it? It could be the big corporate brands and the labels that just end up turning into bulk juice products that nobody gives a shit about. Go back to what Hublin did with Inglenook back in the day when it turned it from one of the most well-known kind of reputable brands that Napa had to offer into a jug wine brand. Completely blew up and destroyed what Inglenook was back in the day. So both on the small side and the big side, you can have your challenges. But hopefully, you find your way through it. All right, I tried to close up the episode and then I went on like another tangent. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate y'all tuning in. This is a great conversation. I love these kind of business marketing kind of, you know, segments that we do because it's the world of this industry that so few people actually get to talk about and get to see. And I hope that some of my personal experience kind of, you know, lends a little credibility to this and some weight to it. I know there are plenty of folks out there that, you know, would probably disagree and probably have, you know, other opinions of how things could or should be done. But, you know, that's up to us, baby. You're on this journey with us. So enjoy the ride. We will see you next week. Love you guys. Thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to follow us on our social networks at MTGA Wines. That's YouTube, The Book of Face, Instagram, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Be sure to leave a rating or a review for the podcast wherever you're consuming your podcasts. For those of you that want to submit some of these questions, again, big shout out to Mike. Thank you so much for the inspiration for today's episode. Head to our website, mtgawines.com. Scroll down that homepage. You'll find that little email form to submit questions. While you're there, you can also check out all of our upcoming events around the country so you can catch either the HBIC herself or me out and about when we're on the road. Have an excellent rest of your day, week, and we will see you next time here on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.